Now, with a new concept like this, we've got talking points that we're not even up to speed on. We're already like behind on our talking points on where we needed to be. But so there's a likelihood we may not get to calls. You have a quick question, text it to 411-923 or send an email to info@rosieonthehouse.com. Justin Rohner, when we're talking on your companion planting and eliminating the insects, that was one of my questions. How are you doing insect and weed control? Because in an agri-scape situation, I'm sure a lot of your guys are pretty purist, pretty organic. I mean, their concept of weed control is, you know, the good old-fashioned hula hoop.
Yeah, and I mean, with weed control, we usually eliminate that by just the density at which we plant, you know, and how we integrate hardscapes into the landscape as well, you know, integrating pathways and seat walls and stuff like that. And then because it's so dense, there's really no room for anything. When we grow with starts, usually we don't do seeds. And so that's another thing on how you can increase your rotation. See, a normal rotation in a agricultural standing when you're doing seeds is you got maybe five seasons per year. But we can increase and add two more by just doing the transplants. And so we'll transplant them at about a four to eight week mark, already into their growing cycle. And then that increases our yields again by just simply how we do those rotations.
Interesting. So are you doing your own starch then somewhere in the laundry room or a pantry or somewhere else, or you just frequent the nursery that much?
Well, we often do it. We recommend if they're going to do it and want to make it be profitable. It's like what Cecilia would do. She's growing her own starch in a little greenhouse or inside her house during the wintertime, you know, or in the summertime. You know, it's doing a protected space, learning how to do that, do it efficiently. That's what we teach in our online mastery program, is teaching them how to grow stuff indoors for themselves. So they have really cheap 50 cent, you know, a start kind of thing. So if you got 50 cent a start, you know that you're going to end up being able to sell per square foot at 782, you know, you got a good investment here. And then you can get the rotation working. And then if you know you can add an extra two seasons, that also kind of justifies the expense of even getting those. So when we're buying from a nursery, we're always looking for the six packs. That's what I like looking for. Six packs, or I'm looking
no
for
no one-offs.
Yeah, no one-offs. No, usually not the 4-inch, unless we're working with herbs that have a higher yield per square foot because of the nature of the veg or the herb that we're working with. Or the types of herbs that sometimes, or the 4-inch pots that they'll actually have multiples all growing in one little pot. And so I can divide out even a watermelon that's got four different watermelons all growing, or four squashes, which I would probably cut them off anyway. But now I can just divide those and actually plant them carefully into my landscape. And now I get more bang for my buck. And then planting those again, getting better seasonality with it when I can do the starts rather than seeds, then that's one of the other ways to just increase that. And again, the densities, keeping the densities high. So I might not even be done harvesting all my sweet potatoes, and I got those vines out there, and then I'm going to be transplanting in between them. I'm putting in some other things like my pumpkins, or I'm putting in some stuff for the winter. I'm putting in my kale starts right in between those things because the sweet potato vine are shallow enough that I can still plant those in there. And now I'm creating a rotation, and I haven't even expired my previous harvest just yet. Or I got watermelon plants right now. You know, they're still hanging on. You know, those watermelon plants are still hanging on, still growing some cool stuff for us. And I'm growing kale right in between them, you know, heading to the next season.
Very interesting. So that plant density takes care of your weed.
Yep.
In a lot of cases. What about insect?
Well, with insect, when you got the right companion plants, like in the summertime, we're doing a lot of marigolds. Marigolds like to deter a lot of pests. You know, in the wintertime, we start throwing in more mint. We put in a lot of alums, the onions, society garlics, you know, a lot of things like that that actually work really good in deterring pests, especially the bigger ones like rabbits. You know, I mean, if you're working around in the front yards and stuff like that, there's ways to design it and allocate your space with the right plantings to be a natural deterrent from any of those crazy pests. And then, you know, we'll give some pests actually a nice smorgasbord of things that they would rather eat, like clover, you know, for the rabbits. We'll give them a little clover space. We'll actually channel them into areas where they can get a fill on that. And then we border all the stuff they would normally eat that we don't want them to. We border that with the society garlics and onions or other garlic plants that are rosemaries and stuff like that, almost create a smell hedge. And then they leave before they even recognize there's anything else there because they're full on the clover that they wanted. So that's another route. And then there's a lot of organic pesticides. I mean, there's a couple pesticide companies that we work with here. They do normal traditional stuff, but then we worked with them specifically to get some organic, very natural products that smell like root beer that they can actually spray around our client properties and get that taken care of.
And that's all related to insects. You had mentioned rabbits. What about cats?
Cats, you know, the ones that leave the Lincoln Logs behind.
Right.
That has a significant issue. We don't like building with those or planting with those.
And right? You don't want that to be in an area that you come back and you're cultivating under, they've been using it a while. And I mean, I excavate. I don't want that composting and mixing with my soil.
No, we don't want that around them at all. I mean, when it comes to food safety laws, they don't let us harvest within 5 feet of any scat that we've found, especially from cats.
Ooh, so I need to change that standard. I was probably more on like the shovel scoop size. 5 feet?
Well, that's food safety laws. It's 5 feet and it's like 90 days of waiting. So it's a devastating thing. And I mean, it's one of the weird laws that's out there. It's kind of like they have it so they can enforce it if they need to. But it's one like, you know, if a coyote wanders through a field and poops, you know, we're not going to, they don't all of a sudden not harvest. They don't quarantine that area because it's not usually found. But if it's found, they got to address it. And that's one of the kind of the things, especially when we're doing inner city stuff. It's like we have to do raised beds. So that's one of the other ways and be able to mess with that and make sure that we're not dealing with cats or dogs or things like that. It's how we actually create the solid scapes or raised beds or how we angle them or how we create buffer spaces and how we design that into the landscape just to ensure that if there is a problem, it's not a problem for our food. And it's very intentional. It was more, there was more detail to it that I didn't even realize we needed to accommodate when we first started this, you know, 18 years ago, you know.
That's interesting. And it's funny that you mentioned like that scat. Well, there's other animals like horses and cows where it's like gold for your garden.
Right. But even with that, I mean, there's different rules about that depending on the age of that manure. It is how long you can really, it needs to be in place before you can really use it and use that space and effectively grow. And it's a 90-day time frame with that as well. And that's one of the things, especially if it starts out fresh. If you can have it almost certified as it's been composted well enough, well, then you can get into more of a 30-day timeline.
I think it's Western Organics. You know what? I'm going to avoid that. We'll talk about it off air because I'm side trailing. So that brings up another question I'm going to interject before we get to water supply. What kind of water demand are we creating with this? But how are you supplementing your soil? This type of turnover, you're probably going through a lot of potted soil bags. Or does this create enough composting done right? You can compost enough to keep up with your replenishing the nutrients in your soil.
You got it. That's the way we do it. We want to try to get a composting site on site for everything that we do and then also bring in any other little scraps from the kitchen and stuff and be able to create a very active living compost pile. When you get compost right, you can get it all to break down in 16 days. So it doesn't have to take months and months like people think. We water our compost pile just like we do a lot of the plants. And we set them up in such a way so that we're layering them right so that they can all break down on their own. And it's not something I have to be out there and be turning it like every single day in order for it to break down correctly. So you're exactly right. We do a lot of on-site composting stuff. We do a lot of compost teas as to our, you know, our nutrient densities. So we can do foliar feeding and we'll, you know, we teach people how to blend their own teas. And I mean, it's like brewing beer, you know, you can do it for $36 and you can make your own brew that'll, in a 5 gallon bucket that it will work, you know, for a good half acre of plantings. And the most nutrient-dense stuff you can get, and things will grow right well for you.
Adding this to my Agriscape plan. Beer. One crop I hadn't thought about coming out of my Agriscape.
Yeah, there you go. And beer works better in the garden than it usually does at the dinner table. That's been my experience with it.
Now, what kind of water demand does all of this create? You had mentioned earlier the example of the gal that had a quarter acre that she turned into an Agriscape.
Right.
What kind of water consumption are we creating on that?
Well, we always want to be less water consumption than your neighbor, but there's a way we do that. I mean, it's going to be less than grass in most instances, even if you're fully dense, you know, and you're totally loaded up. You're going to be less than grass, especially the, you know, your rye, your traditional rye. You're going to be less than that. And what we integrate is we'll integrate gray water sourcing. So in the state of Arizona, you got a general use permit that allows you to use and tap into gray water, you know, your laundry water, and you can subsurface that. You know, as long as it's not sprayed, it's okay kind of thing. And there's a lot of other things that we like to tap into, rainwater harvesting. So like that gal, her quarter acre, a lot of rainwater harvesting, rain barrels that we put all around that property that she cultivated and just collected all that water from that. And she used it with just a hose, or we integrated it into her, you know, little pump, and it can go into her irrigation system. So it's a lot of that. I've got a tub and two sinks that we tap into at my house from our upstairs. There's enough water that flows through that for 10,000 plant units a day, just regular use with my family. And a plant unit would be like a 1-quart container pot. So a nice, you know, a nice head of lettuce. So I've got enough water just coming from my normal usage that I could integrate right into my landscape to help it water. And I use a lot less water than my neighbors do, but you wouldn't know it by all the bananas and mangoes and other things that were growing off of that water.
So by design, it's a complete agriscape system. It takes everything. You're using less water. You're making money off of it. Does it limit itself to plants? I mean, if we're agriscaping, a big part of agriculture in Arizona is cattle, sheep, goats, and even there's a lot of things that those animals bring that aren't necessarily meat products, soaps. We made our own goat soap. We have our own goat milk. I mean, it's something we just milk right in the backyard and turn it into product in the kitchen. Is agriscaping in your designs limited to plants?
Oh, no. So productive pets is what you're describing. We like to call them productive pets. And we call them productive pets for a main reason, because integrating productive pets into an HOA environment is a little tricky, but totally doable. A lot of cities, I know Gilbert just opened up their range. We've been working with the city for 6 years in the town of Gilbert, that they expanded the opportunity for raising chickens. You know, we had to call them ornamental jungle fowl for quite a while. And we had to focus on breeds that did not look like your traditional chicken. You know, we had to focus on breeds that, you know, like silkies or sultans and, you know, ones that look like cockatoos like my neighbor had. Yeah, the Polish, you know, with the crazy poofs on the top of their head, right? You know, so we had to do that for a number of years before regulations started not having a prejudice against productive pets. And now we're starting to weed out a lot of the prejudice jargon in a lot of the code. And for all you city people out there, it's like, you know, you've got prejudice jargon in your code. Start weeding it out. You know, make it more about smells and sounds, not about what kind of animal someone has. But that's the kind of thing we love to integrate that into the designs. And that becomes part of the composting process as well. You know, chickens are a big part of our composting system. Guinea pigs are also part of our composting system because they can compost our citrus. And I'd rather have that than a rat.
Yeah. That's a good point. Guinea pigs?
Guinea pigs. Yeah, guinea pigs.
I got to write that down.
Same as a rat in terms of what they're willing to eat. And they're about the only animal that we found that will do that. And they pelletize things right well, you know, for the garden.
You know, the pendulum swings. You'd mentioned the verbiage and HOAs that limit it. And everything had gotten so structured there at a point. And I think people are kind of swinging back that they need to look at things in a practical application.
Yeah.
You know, solar panels, for how long you couldn't put on HOAs in Arizona. And finally, they looked at that and said, this is ridiculous. Why are we wasting all this sun and restricting ourselves? And you know, you've got your agriscaping coming back in a lot of these HOAs that, you know, there's a practical aspect of life that, you know, you can't put into regulations on your CC&Rs and HOAs and, you know, basic lifestyles that is what got us through the first 6,000 years of our existence.
Right. It's focusing on what we're for rather than what we're against. It's like we can protect people's, you know, sacred spaces and the sounds, you know, and the smells. But when it comes down to it, it's like really respecting people and what they want to do with their own life. I mean, it's allowing them to choose. And I think that's a big part of it.
Justin Rohner, the concept's agriscaping. The company's agriscaping. Elegant, edible landscape.